I've been told if you can, try to use the microphones as much as possible because we are taping the proceedings. We're a little bit behind, but we're okay. For the next sessions, we're going to change things a bit. There are panels. What we'll do is each speaker will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have questions immediately after each speaker in the usual way. About 5 minutes of questions, or however is needed. And then at the very end of each panel, we can have a global discussion if there is a need for that. So the next session is going to be moderated by Maya Kokoeva, who is a relatively new assistant professor here at McGill University, works on the neurobiology of appetite control. And she will run this session with a steel fist and make sure all the speakers stay on time.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to chair this session because it is by and large centered on a structure which is at the heart of my own research, and this structure, it might be maybe too bold to say this, that this structure, and maybe probably not everyone will agree with this, this structure I consider as a realm of energy homeostasis, because, and this structure is the one where all roads lead to. So this is, how can I move further? Okay, perfect. This is the hypothalamus. It is a highly complex structure located at the bottom of the brain, and a majority of neuroscientists try to avoid it because of its complexity. This structure controls very, very basic regulatory processes such as water balance, stress, hunger, reproduction, thermoregulation, sleep-wake, satiety. But from the other side, it is a nice structure to work with because these are basic functions, and the readouts are also very robust. So you don't, when you, for example, work on energy homeostasis, when you do some manipulations on using your model organism, you don't need to train mouse to eat. It will eat either more or less, and then if you are lucky, you will have some difference with your modification. So I won't go further into hypothalamic control of energy homeostasis because our speakers will do this. First speaker is Dr. William Chalmers. Dr. Chalmers is professor and Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Medical Scientist at the Department of Pharmacology of the University of Alberta. Dr. Chalmers did his PhD at, I was surprised to find this out, at the University of Regensburg in Germany. Since then, he published crucial studies on the role of neuropeptides in hypothalamic control of energy homeostasis. But besides studies on hypothalamic control of energy homeostasis, Dr. Chalmers has quite a bright range of interests, studying as well anxiety, addiction, and epilepsy, which is very impressive. Today, Dr. Chalmers will be speaking on hypothalamic neuropeptides and the regulation of energy balance. Please.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the organizers very much. Loret, who I have not met yet or met for us last night, and it's a very charming hostess, and our friend Alain Daguerre. As Maya sort of indicated, I've been interested in the central regulation of energy balance for a number of years, and unlike some of the previous speakers, I'm looking at it from a very specifically mechanistic point of view. I'm interested in how nerve cells work, what makes them behave in very very different fashions, and we tend to look at individual nerve cells, their behavior, their inputs, and their responses to energy balance related signals. So I'm going to try and talk to you a little bit about that today. I don't really need to introduce this topic after John Blundell's elegant talk. Eating is a behavior. Ingestion of food is essential for survival, and it's probably far more important than anything else we do, including reproduction. So because eating is a behavior, obviously overeating is a behavior, and as we've heard this morning already, there are many factors that play an important role in the regulation of this. One of the points that has been sort of danced around a little bit this morning for probably pretty good reasons is the idea of a set point. So people have postulated for quite a long period of time that there's a ideal body weight, I mean, certainly one hears that, an ideal body weight, which is regulated, and based on the Framingham study, is regulated quite accurately. As Sadaf Farooqi likes to talk about, the accuracy with which people who are not constantly faced with highly caloric, palatable foods, they can control the accuracy of their body weight within the caloric content of something like a slice of cucumber per day. It's highly stable and over long periods of time, and it suggests that there's a homeostatic mechanism which can become deranged in a variety of states. And one of the points I wanted to bring out is some elegant work that Rudy Leibel has done in Colombia. So humans, essentially of any body mass index, when their average caloric intake is established and then reduced by 10 to 20% in an experimental situation over a long period of time, show a reduction in energy output, largely in the non-resting as well as in the resting energy expenditure, and this happens over months. It's stable, so it's clear that the whatever processes in the brain are around are capable of noticing the difference in between what the brain considers an ideal body weight and what compensates for that by reducing energy expenditure. And interestingly, this happens no matter what your BMI is. So whether you're slender or grossly overweight, this physiological process happens. So this, of course, interferes dramatically with our ability to lose weight when we want to. So the voluntary versus the non-voluntary becomes a really important issue. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about the machinery within the hypothalamus. So all of these signals, both in the periphery and within the brain, play into hypothalamic nuclei and play a role in regulation, as we know from a variety of thousands and thousands of different experiments. Examining the roles of leptin, of neuropeptide Y, and melanocortins, among other many important signals. So I'm going to try and talk a little bit about some of the regions of the brain in the hypothalamus, which we think are very important in the regulation of energy balance, and what goes on there within those little black boxes. I'm just going to highlight something that's probably familiar to many of you, but certainly the aficionados. But a region in the hypothalamus called the arcuate nucleus has neurons that make a variety of signals. One set of signals is neuropeptide Y and AGRP, or agouti-related peptide. These signals, when injected into the brain, will make an animal eat, whereas POMC, or pro-opio melanocortin, which is a precursor protein which is broken into a variety of things, but in this case is made into alpha-melanocyte-stimulating hormone, or alpha-MSH, and CART, or cocaine and amphetamine-related transcript, which is a particular interest of both myself and my colleague, Kevin, are they both make animals stop eating. So these neurons project into a variety of regions, including the lateral hypothalamus, the paraventricular nucleus, and a variety of other target regions, and are thought to be incredibly important in regulation of energy balance because both of these neuron subtypes express receptors for the hormone leptin, which reaches the brain via a transporter system. There are also other important regions of the brain, such as the subfornical organ and the nucleus tractus solitarius and the area postrema, which are these are regions outside, which have parts outside the blood-brain barrier, can sense incoming signals from the periphery, and the nucleus tractus solitarius is in fact a convergent signal for vagal afferents, which provide sensory input into the brain from the periphery. So there's feedback and there's output regions as well as input regions. When we look at neurons here in the arcuate nucleus, which express neuropeptide Y, the brighter red is are neurons that make NPY, and you can see that these cells then send their fibers throughout the PVN. The paraventricular nucleus is very sharply innervated both by neuropeptide Y and by melanocortin peptides. So if we look at NPY and its actions in the brain, what it causes is a massive feeding response. So you can get animals, give NPY to the animals, and they will, if they're fully satiated already, they will eat as much or more than they would have eaten in an entire day. When you continue this, if you give NPY day after day after day, you get animals that become frankly obese. And so this it's a very potent hunger factor. They also show other responses consistent with the starvation reflex in that they also, animals exposed to this, suppress energy expenditure. They become lazy. They sit around and just simply eat anything that walks by but don't actively chase it. So, again, it's consistent with what you would want to do if you're starving. As I pointed out, these nuclei, particularly the PVN, the arcuate, make lots of NPY and distribute it to a variety of hypothalamic nuclei. And injections of NPY into the PVN make animals eat quite strongly. We're going to concentrate on the actions of NPY on parvocellular neurons because people found that in the whole animal, when you inject NPY, the parvocellular neurons, the small neurons, show signs of having been excited by NPY. So that's always a good thing when you're looking for neurophysiology. So what we decided to do is look at the electrical behavior of neurons within the PVN, look at what NPY did, and then we could perhaps make some connection between the actions of NPY on these neurons and feeding behavior. It's a long stretch because we've separated the behavior from the animal very early on with a fairly sharp blade. But we're going to use NPY because we know what it does on behavior as a tool to try and identify both hypothalamic neurons and their mechanisms that regulate energy balance. This is a schematic showing the neurons of the arcuate nucleus. These have neuropeptide Y and AGRP, and interestingly also contain GABA. And these neurons contain alpha-MSH and CART. These are anorexigenic, that is, they suppress food intake. These are orexigenic, they make you eat. And these neurons also contain GABA, which turns out to be important for a variety of other reasons I won't get into today. So what we can do is we can record from one of these parvocellular neurons by their appearance. We can stimulate synaptic inputs. We can look at their behavior. And we can ask a variety of questions in this configuration about what effects it has on the properties of neurons or their inputs. Just to explain again, our nerve terminal can be stimulated electrically. We can record responses to that in the postsynaptic cell using patch pipettes. This is sort of wholesale voltage clamp recordings. So we can look at the response and synaptic responses in this with a great detail of accuracy. And Dennis Burdikoff will talk a bit more about some of these responses and his techniques as well. So we will be focusing in this case largely on the response to a stimulus which causes the release of GABA. When we do this recording, we record from a parvocellular neuron and apply a stimulus shock here. We can see that there's a nice outward current. This is caused by the release of GABA. It would normally inhibit these neurons, but because we have them in voltage clamp, we see this very nice this nice outward current. When we apply neuropeptide Y, we see a profound effect on the release of GABA, and when we wash it out, it comes back. So this would be a net trend to disinhibit, that is, make cells more excitable, consistent with what other people have described. So this is an interesting point, but big deal. Does it have anything to do with responses, the behavioral responses at all? Well, we thought, all right, so if MPY causes animals to eat and we get the suppression of a GABA response, what do the melanocortins, which make neurons, make animals less likely to eat, what do they do to the properties that we're looking at? And in a neuron where this GABA response in one of these parvocellular neurons, which is sensitive to MPY, if we apply alpha MSH or other agonists, instead of seeing a decrease, we see an increase to that. AGRP, which is contained in the MPY neurons, is a very odd peptide indeed, because unlike most other substances that activate receptors, the sole purpose of this peptide seems to be as an antagonist to melanocortin receptors. So it blocks the melanocortin system at the same time as MPY has its other effects. So it's a synergistic but different pathways activity. And when we apply AGRP to this exact same neuron and apply alpha-MSH in its presence, it blocks it. So at least we have opposite effects of peptides that have opposite effects on behavior. So this at least appears to be a reasonable readout, and I'm going to try and convince you that some of what we've seen is in fact relevant to behavior. So a number of questions arose from these fundamental observations that we made a number of years ago, and one of which is, when you're a little mammal and you start, you're hungry. Now, what are the signals that are involved in regulating your appetite? And do all these signals work the same way as you get older and as you stop, as you're suckling, and as you switch? So we examined the responses that we looked at, the melanocortin and MPY responses in the PVN, over developmental time. So we looked at neurons in young mammals, that is young rats, from day postnatal 7 on, which is the earliest that we could define the PVN, and recorded responses from two different kinds of neurons. The parvocellular neurons have a mix of cell types. These steadily firing cells are called neurosecretory cells, and these neurons that fire this very sharp, intense burst of activity have been defined as preautonomic by their targets. So these neurons project to the median eminence and release hormones like corticotropin releasing factor as part of the HPA axis, and these neurons release other factors down to the area postrema the nucleus tractus solitarius and are involved in autonomic behaviors. What we found was that both types of neurons begin very early on responding strongly to neuropeptide Y. And as the animals get older, towards weaning, after weaning, the MPY responses remain very, very strong in neurons of this neurosecretory type. But the preautonomic neurons, although they start out being sensitive to MPY, drop their responses to MPY. Very few of them respond with time. Interestingly, these neurons as well, the neurosecretory cells, start with relatively few relatively few of them respond to melanocortins. This percentage increases substantially with time, whereas the preautonomic cells don't. So what this is telling us is that these neurons, these neurosecretory cells, and actually all of them seem to be sensitive to MPY, and only a few of them start responding to melanocortins. What is interesting about that is that when you're a baby rat or a baby human, all you need to know when you start out is that you're hungry or you're full, because the quality of the food that you eat is defined by the fact that your mother's giving it to you. So as you get older, though, and you have to start foraging for food and determining your own thing, then it's important that you evaluate the quality of the food that you get. So the melanocortin system, which tells you that you're full, that your energy stores have been refilled, becomes much more important then. So just being full alone isn't any good. So the last little story I want to tell is about fat, and that is we're all interested in obesity. What we've looked at up to now is animals under perfectly normal physiological conditions. They're given a low-fat diet or a relatively low-fat diet, and they respond this way. What happens when we get these guys fat? What changes? Because do they defend a higher body weight set point? And the answer is to some of these, yes. And what happens to these responses? So when we take Sprague-Dawley rats and put them on a high-fat diet, it tastes like sugar cookies, it's lots of fat, lots of sucrose in it, things like that, they love it. And if you put them on this high-fat diet, a substantial number of them, not all, but a substantial number, become obese. And when you take them off this high-fat diet, they defend their high body weight set point. So this, you can take this out for a number of weeks, and the guys on high-fat diet will actually always be heavier. They defend that higher body weight set point, which is a good model for human obesity because, you know, when I've gained weight over the years, and I tend to defend that extra few pounds myself. So it turns out to be a nice model with the right species of rat. And so we started looking at these responses I just showed you. And if we look and plot the net gain, body weight gain that the animals made over their litter mates that were on chow versus the amplitude of the responses that we were looking at, the responses to MPY seem to be entirely independent of the weight gained. But the melanocortin system appears to be strongly suppressed. So the fatter those animals got, the less the response in the melanocortin system is. And that suggests very strongly that what's happening is that the system has become less sensitive over time. Now, what the mechanism is, we're not entirely sure, and we're looking into that. So this is unpublished data yet. But these are very exciting findings that suggest that the homeostat itself is subject to modulation. So I'm just a bit of a summary here. I'm just going to tell you one more little quick story because the PVN is only one of the regions that's interesting for this, and that is the ventromedial nucleus is also a satiety region, and the VMN is important in sensing leptin, and it appears to be important in regulating the activity of the melanocortin neurons in the arcuate nucleus. MPY is also effective at causing food intake. So what does it do in the VMN? Well, we use the brain slice technique that we've been talking about before. This is a nice picture showing this is the ventromedial nucleus. Down here is the arcuate. This is our infrared camera image. And we can take neurons like this that also manufacture a fluorescent protein driven by the leptin receptor promoter. And so we can get cells that glow, we can record from them, and look at the responses. Well, it turns out that when you apply neuropeptide Y to neurons such as this, they're hyperpolarized and they're made less excitable, so they fire less in response to the same kind of stimulus as before. This is a postsynaptic effect caused by activation of a potassium channel. But that's kind of cool, but not necessarily stunning. What's interesting is that if you apply leptin to these neurons, leptin excites them. So leptin is constantly there. Leptin is constantly exciting these cells. So it suggests that when MPY comes in a short period of time, it reduces tonically excited neurons' activity, and these neurons tend by themselves to excite melanocortin neurons. To summarize, we have these tools that allow us to ask questions that aren't as easy to ask with, let's say, a whole human functional MRI. And we've been able to see that these energy balance related peptides that I've talked about appear to be important in regulation of GABA transmission in the PVN and glutamate responses in the arcuate. The other nice thing that I think we've shown over the years is that the in vitro physiology, the microphysiology in brain slices, is able to help predict behavior. And this this vulnerability that we've seen to high-fat diet appears to correspond quite nicely to a loss of sensitivity to the melanocortin system, which are the ones that tell you to stop eating. So it's pretty clear, based on just these relatively few signals that in our study, that the interplay between a large number of chemical messengers and hypothalamic nuclei provides a complex balance of commands that regulate energy balance. I'd like to thank people in my laboratory, my collaborators, and my funding agencies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. I'll ask first question.
Sure.
I will use. So it's very interesting to see that diet-induced obesity is inducing, generating a resistance to MT2. So mm-hmm. that it's in line with leptin development of leptin resistance in diet-induced obese models, right? So do you think that that the neurons or brain is getting resistant to any orexigenic signal, or just to it is specific to melanocortin pathway?
I think that's a very very good question. The work on leptin receptor insensitivity suggests is that there's a double effect. That is, there is a reduction in leptin sensitivity throughout, because the MPY neurons are inhibited by leptin, so it suggests that they would be less inhibited by leptin. These cells, the melanocortin cells, would be less excited. But it also suggests that the melanocortin signals downstream are less effective.
Right.
So it's a double whammy.
Wow. Interesting.
And just a comment. There's also been...
Hello. This is just a comment that it's also just been reported that high-fat diet will also induce ghrelin resistance. Certainly at the level of the archaeopteryx.
That's interesting. Yeah, I saw this and there was a post on what he saw. This data, yes. So, any other questions?
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.